Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
He was a captain of the Douglas County Sheriff's Police Department, I believe, in Omaha. And he's written some books. He's got a new one coming out in June. So let's get him started. It's Dean T. Olson. How you doing, Dean?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's a pleasure. So, Dean, first time on the show. So let's tell the audience who you are. Like, I kind of have a briefing, but let's go into a little bit more. So you had 30 years on the police department?
Yeah, it's actually the sheriff's department here in Omaha. I started in 1978, retired in 2008, 30 years of service with the department, and retired as a captain in charge of the Criminal Investigation Bureau.
Wow. What can I say? That's great. How did you get into writing books? Because I know that this Evil Desire, which is the one that comes out in June, is not your first book. What led you to getting into writing?
I wrote some articles off and on during my career, and just kind of always had an interest in writing. And when I retired, I had more time to pursue that, because when I was still working, obviously, I was quite busy with my career. But after retirement, I had more time and wrote a couple of books and had them published. And then I decided that I wanted to write about some of the sex crimes that I investigated, because I didn't see a lot of books out there specifically written by investigators who had actually worked the cases. There are a lot of books out there on homicides, because obviously they generate a lot of attention, but the ones on actual rape cases that are written by detectives that work the cases seem to be kind of hit or miss, hard to find. So I decided to write about some of the cases I had worked.
So why do you think that is? Why has there been such a lack of writing in this department?
You know, I'm not sure. I think primarily because homicides generate a lot more tension and fear, and they're a lot more titillating to readers to read about murder, because it is such a heinous crime. But I think on sex assaults, maybe it falls through the cracks, because it doesn't rise to the level of homicide in many cases.
I guess now a lot of the crimes, are a lot of them solved? Or is there a high percentage that actually don't get solved?
Unlike murder, where you're stuck with a body, it's hard to get rid of a body. Sex assaults, many of them go unreported. So unfortunately for the criminal justice system, and even worse so for the victims, most rape crimes are not solved.
Wow. How does that work for us as an investigator? So when you're doing sex crimes, it's a real uphill battle then for you.
Well, it can be, but a lot of the rape cases don't get reported in the first place because of the stigma attached to rape. So they don't even come to the attention of law enforcement, and many victims suffer in silence, and rapists are free to continue to, you know, assault victims because they're unknown to the police. And so every time you have a victim that comes forward, it's almost a blessing in disguise because you get a chance then to get the information from them, get their assistance, and they're brave enough to come forward so you can work the case and try to identify this guy, get him off the street.
Yeah, it's pretty, that must be a really hard part of policing. So some of the cases, I guess you see some pretty wild, some pretty brutal cases. What are some of the most, I don't know, I don't want to say awesome, but the ones that really stick out or stay with you?
A lot of them stay with you because you deal with human emotions and things like that. But probably one of the worst that I worked was the case I write about in the book called the Babysitter Killers.
No. So that was actually a series of babysitters, or?
No, it was one babysitter, one night, two juveniles. Actually, one was 18, so he's considered an adult in the eyes of the court. But his accomplice was a 16-year-old, and they broke into a house where they knew that a young girl was babysitting, beat her, raped her, tortured her, murdered her while a 6-year-old child slept in a bedroom next door.
What do you think makes someone do that? I mean, that's a huge question, I know. But, like, I just try to wrap my head around that in the sense of actually plotting it out and getting some young 16-year-old and doing all this. Like, what's wrong with that person?
Well, I think in this case, the fact I described some of the dysfunction in the family, his dad was a sex offender who was in prison in another state at the time. His older brother, I believe, was arrested a number of years after the murder for an unrelated sexual assault. So obviously the kid comes from a dysfunctional family, an antisocial family. But I think it's just pure and simple. It's evil. I mean, it's unfortunately, it involves or it envelops people that aren't innocent people, and they pay a heck of a price for it.
So what do you hope people get out of the book?
Well, probably a better understanding on how these crimes are committed, the nature and type of people that commit the crimes, the suspects involved, what their motivations are, and hopefully a better understanding of the crime of rape so that they can maybe look with a little more educated eye at how these crimes occur and why. And you know, a lot of times, if I write in the book about the fact that one of the last cases I worked before retirement was a case where prostitutes were involved, and it was kind of an unfortunate case because prostitutes in many ways are considered disposable victims. They don't have a lot of status in society, and a lot of police officers look on them as not being, you can't rape a prostitute because they sell their bodies for money. And unfortunately, in this case, the rapist, his name was Henry Camphouse. He raped at least 8 women, 8 prostitutes, one that was not a prostitute. And when it came time to go to trial, the prosecutor decided that because the victims, in many cases, were prostitutes, they couldn't be located, and they weren't probably as reliable a witness as other victims are. He decided to plea bargain.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say we've had a lot of this type of crime, like, you know, and the New Bedford killer and different serial killers and prostitutes and people on the street as well, poor people, drug addicts, and even a lot of times in the gay community. So it seems to be kind of a choice for a lot of these killers and attackers, rapers and stuff. A lot of times when we talk on that side, they say that the policing doesn't care as much about them and don't spend as much time or effort on cases when you have, you know, street people, prostitutes, stuff like that. But you being in on the other side, being the policing, how do you address that? How do you find that to be?
Well, I look upon him as a victim rather than their status as a prostitute or any other choice they make in life. And, you know, one of the problems with not investigating rapes of prostitutes is that the perpetrators in these cases often attack women who aren't prostitutes. So, you know, you run the risk of you ignore the rape of a prostitute, but then you turn around and you've got a guy that will attack, you know, an innocent victim who's not a a prostitute, maybe a woman who's in the wrong part of town, or, you know, one case I describe in the book, a woman who was a chronic drug user, and these guys are predators. They know how to spot these people. They know how to target them. And so she was simply walking home after a party using a lot of drugs, and he drove up on her. She wasn't a prostitute, and attacked her. So, you know, it's kind of short-sighted on a number of levels, including the fact that they don't always confine themselves to raping prostitutes.
Yeah, I, like I said, it must be a really real, real hard and real challenging to deal with that. Now, and as police, how many cases do average detectives get at a time? Like, are you guys overwhelmed?
A lot of times we're stretched thin. It's kind of an axiom in the business that if you're not overworked, you're not doing your job. But, you know, the cases vary depending on the jurisdiction and things like that. But most of the time, I recall from my days as an investigator, as a detective, I was stretched pretty thin. I was running from case to case and trying to make cases. And, you know, and then you have the components that go with the investigation. An important one is testifying in court. And so that ties you up because you can't then be out on the street trying to identify these people. But, yeah, I would say that probably you ask any detective and they're going to tell you that they're working really hard and overstretched.
Is there anything you would want to see changed in the policing area as far as detectives and things like that on these cases?
Well, they just had, and I'm not going to identify the agency, but they had an incident in Michigan recently where they found that the officers, the social attitude of the officers towards some of the victims was that they didn't tell their stories convincingly, so therefore they weren't going to actively investigate the rape. And in the process, they had amassed a staggering number of rape kits that they didn't send through for processing simply because they had this preconceived notion about how a rape victim should react and respond. And so ultimately, they ended up with I think it was 10,000 or more rape kits that had never been processed. They had a new prosecutor come in, he or she, I don't remember which one it was, but they looked at the number of backlogged rape cases and said, you know, we got to do something with these rape kits. And so they started rushing them through under federal grants to get them into the CODIS system, which is a federal database that stores DNA profiles. And in the process, they found out that they had identified the ones they had processed so far, which wasn't all of them. They had identified 39 serial rapists responsible for crimes up to including rape and murder in 39 states. And so the dangers of not following through on these rape investigations and basically doing your job was that you have a lot of other victims out there that didn't need to be victimized because the guy would have been taken off the street in the first place.
Mm. Yeah, I have to mention that you have written a couple of books before.
Yes, I did.
Now, they seem to be more examining, like, the perfect enemy. So that's law enforcement for Islamic terrorists. Wow, that's a complete opposite of what you're doing now. What was that about?
Well, when I earned a second master's degree from the Center for Homeland Defense and Security at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, and I wanted to use that knowledge that I gained in working on that degree to acquaint cops with the information regarding Islamist terrorism because I felt that there was not a lot of that information out there. And some of the stuff that was out there was bad or incorrect information. So that was the first book I wrote. And then I followed that up with a second book on terrorism. And but this most recent book, Evil Desire, I wanted to get into more an autobiographical view of some of the cases I worked. And in the process, probably address some of the misconceptions about rape and basically talk about what I consider to be some of the most interesting cases I ever worked.
What do you think the biggest misconception is about rape?
I don't know if there's one particular misconception. I think there's a handful of misconceptions, and one of them is, and it's pretty prevalent because you even see judges to this day that, and there was one in Canada that, you know, basically said that a rape victim must not have been resisting hard enough if she allowed the rape to occur because she could have kept her legs together or something, some ridiculous notion like that. And so you, in the most recent case, I didn't study it closely, but it's a Baylor University student was basically acquitted of crimes because the judge didn't believe that the victim was serious enough or resisted enough or whatever one of these myths about rape affected his judgment. And so you have these pervasive myths about what the crime is, what it involves, and the victim's role in it. And you know, it's unfortunate because it does affect sentencing. It affects prosecutors. They, you know, may feel that, well, you know, yeah, this is a crime, but maybe it's not all the perpetrator's fault. Maybe the victim placed herself in a position where she got raped in the first place. And so there's a lot of blame that gets shifted onto a victim, which isn't fair, and it's unjust, and it leads to bad decisions in the criminal justice process.
Where do you think all that opinion comes from? Like, why do you think people feel that way?
You know, I don't know. I've never really thought about it, but it's probably societal attitudes towards men and, you know, their role in courting and things like that. I remember one time one of the schools or training sessions I attended, the guy was a legendary FBI profiler. His name was Lee Hazelwood, and he had made a comment, something to the effect that, you know, crime is basically an overly aggressive courtship. And he said it's not. He said it's an act of sexual violence. And if people still harbor those misconceptions, then, you know, they make up juries, they become judges, prosecutors, things like that. If they harbor those misconceptions, then these things will occur.
I guess quite often the rape is really about power and control, isn't it?
All the time it's about power and control. And in some cases, there are four basic types of rapists. The one in particular, the anger excitation rapist, it's about humiliation in addition to the power and the control. So you end up with a suspect who does everything he can to humiliate, dominate, control, and manipulate his victim for his evil desire.
How do you feel this has affected your own life, your personal life in that sense? Like when you go through all these cases and you spent all this time in policing, you know, 30 years, and seeing people in such a violent manner, such a bad manner, this must have an effect on you as well.
It does off and on, but I think over the years, you know, you learn how to deal with it. And one of the guys who mentored me in my career had mentioned a comment, or made the comment, he described it as functional stoicism. You learn how to detach your emotions from what you're seeing, the horrors that you're seeing, and the tremendous suffering and violence, that you can do your job. So he said, well, other people have the luxury of, you know, breaking down and being overcome by emotions. You have a job to do. And so that functional stoicism kind of steps in, and you learn how to deal with it by maybe putting it in on the back burner until you're done, and then you can deal with it in private.
Hmm. I guess you must see some really weird cases too in sex crimes, like some real off the beaten path, things you don't expect.
Yeah, you know, it's funny about the sex crimes investigation position is that you deal with exposers, people that, you know, men that flash women in apartment complexes or wherever. And one of the things I found, and when you start peeling back the layers of the onion to investigate a case like that, is that there are whole groups or societies out there that have a lot of members. They meet on a regular basis. And you find out that there are a lot more of these people out there. They may not commit crimes, but they have these compulsions. And one guy in particular I had, he was a exposer, and his MO was he would drive up to a late night taco joint or like a Taco Bell or someplace like that, and he would have his pants down around his knees. He'd pull through the drive-thru so that most of the time he knew it was probably going to be a young girl working there, and then he would expose himself. And when I tracked him down, because she was smart enough to get his license number, he had used a friend's car. It took a little digging, but I found out who he was. And when I asked him about it, he said, well, I just come from softball practice earlier in the day, and I had a rash, and I was trying to, you know, let the lotion settle in and stuff. So they've got a lot of really BS excuses and stuff. I told the gal, you know, when I interviewed her, I said, you know, you had a hot cup of coffee in your hands. Why don't you throw it in his lap? I probably would have solved the problem for a while. But, you know, obviously she was very frightened and put off by it, because he kept trying to see if she was looking at him. And, you know, of course, she's trying to get him out of away from the window because she was scared to death. But, you know, it sounds kind of humorous at times, but it's also telling that a lot of these guys will go on to do more than just expose themselves. A lot of times it's a fantasy thing that leads up to them. Part of the fantasy is they expose themselves, and then they go on to have sex with the victim. So it can actually lead to rape. But one of the cases I worked was a guy that was, he would hang around jogging trails, and you see women jogging, and then by themselves, he would jump out from the parking spot near the jogging trail and expose himself, and he'd take his license plates off. So it took a little tracking down in that case to find him. But one of the things I did was I found out there was a meeting for these people. I can't remember what the name of the group was, but they would meet at a local restaurant one night a week and discuss their cases. Sometimes they were court-ordered to meet. And I drove through the parking lot, and I looked for cars that matched the description of the one the victims had given me. And sure as heck, there sits this car, and it was a fairly distinctive older model Toyota. Got the license number and tracked him down through his registration, and he freely admitted it. He said, I can't control myself. And, a lot of that's out there. It's kind of a subculture that people don't know about because they're not exposed to it.
You know, it's pretty interesting. You know, we hear a lot about this, and we also hear a lot of times people think that, there's an issue with doing something like that lady in the drive-thru. If she poured coffee on him and hurt him, burned him, or if you attack your attacker, you could actually be charged and be in trouble for doing that.
Yeah, and I think it's probably not wise to handle it yourself that way. I know that, you know, it sounds kind of humorous to talk about a girl working at a fast food drive-thru throwing a hot cup of coffee on an exposer's lap. But again, the prudent thing is to call the professionals, call 911, have the police come out, take a report, and have an investigator follow up on it. You never know. Sometimes these people are capable of very high levels of violence, and so you might precipitate it. And obviously, if you're in a drive-thru, you've got some protection because you're inside a building, you've got other workers around, but especially a woman who confronts somebody on a jogging path, you know, what's her, the guy, and nobody else around, it's dangerous.
Yeah, it's such a crazy thing, and crime and the whole thing. Is there particular areas or things that people do that they could, stay away from? Is there areas that people like predators look for?
Predators are interesting because they're very much like animal predators. They know how to focus on people who walk a particular way that indicates that they may not be paying attention to their surroundings, or they may not be physically capable of escaping if they try to move on them, that type of thing. And they actually did some psychological studies. One of the researchers was a guy named Grayson. I can't remember his partner, but they went to a penitentiary and they showed muggers who were in the pen. They said, showed them videotapes of people walking down the street. And they said, look at these people and tell us which ones you would attack and then tell us why. And they looked at the way they walked and, you know, the way they carried themselves, if they had their heads down or they were alert and looking around. And almost unanimously, the predators came back and they said the people that walked because they indicated maybe they had a limp or, you know, were not physically fit, you know, they walked, they weren't aware of their surroundings, they would attack them because they knew it would be relatively easy to take their purse or mug them by taking their wallet or whatever. So the same type of predatory skills that an animal uses to pick out the weak, the same thing a human predators use to target victims.
How are the stats on rate now? Are they going up, going down? Like, what kind of crime rates going on there?
Well, it used to be that I think the numbers back in the 80s, mid-80s, when I was an active detective before I became a supervisor and administrator, was you had a rape was committed every 4 minutes. I think the numbers now are that a rape occurs every minute in the United States. And those are rapes that occur but may not be reported. So I don't know if the numbers are going up or down. I saw one site recently that said that the number of rapes had gone down slightly as a percentage of the population, but that the actual number was higher because the population had gotten bigger. So, of course, you had the number of predators grew as well. But 91% of rape victims are female. And, of course, so what people don't realize is the other 9% are male. And a lot of people don't realize that males can be victims of rape also. But it's interesting. One of the statistics I saw that kind of brought home this the dangers of rape and how what an impact it has on society is that of every 1,000 rapes, it is estimated that 995 perpetrators will walk.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Free, they'll never be arrested or prosecuted for the crime.
So, and male rape, so that's primarily from other males, or is that from females?
Sometimes it's females. We had some of the cases are considered what are classified as statutory rapes, where you have an older woman, for example, will cultivate teenage boys. And, you know, in the past, that might not have been looked upon as rape, maybe viewed as a rite of passage that a 13, 14, 15-year-old boy was having sex with a 25, a 35-year-old woman. But now we understand that, you know, rape is not a crime of of sex. It's a crime of violence. It's a way to dominate and have power, control over a person. And so they realize that these are not rites of passage. These are actual sexual assaults in the same manner as a male raping a woman. But they called them statutory rapes because the victims were statutorily under the age of consent, even though, you know, in the olden days, you'd look at that, it's, oh, it's a lucky kid, you know, he's 16 years old, he's having sex with a 30-year-old woman. Well, those myths are pretty much being exploded now because you realize the long-term consequences those types of crimes have on the victims. And, you know, one thing that really troubles me, and I have no idea why it's occurring, are the number of teachers now that are seem to be getting caught up. Yeah, I have no idea what's going on there. I haven't worked those cases in years, but just a lot of teachers, male and female, having sex with underage kids or students and former students. It's really a troubling situation.
Yeah, I find that really surprising. I know in Seattle we've had a few. It seems to be pretty regular in times. Like you hear it a couple of times a year. I don't quite get it. I don't quite get what they see in it myself, but, you know.
Well, what I don't understand is, you know, are we seeing it more because people are reporting it more often? Is that what's going on, or is there actually an actual number, an increase in the number of people that are doing this? Because it used to be the teachers were well-respected, and they still are in many cases, but, you know, you would never consider a teacher as a predator and have to worry about your teacher or your child's teacher. But it seems like anymore, you know, more and more of these cases crop up. And like you said, you know, it seems like every week or every month there's a couple of new cases. And it's not just Seattle. It's here in Omaha. It seems like it's everywhere. And it's just that, to me, it's an unfortunate situation because now you have, if you consider teachers as a group of potential predators, what richer hunting ground can there be than a bunch of impressionable kids that are taught to kind of obey you and listen to you and look up to you and admire you? Easy to groom people like that if you're that type of predator.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I was gonna, that was kind of my question there, was going to be about the teachers and where they're going and why there's so many, it seems. I guess it could just be more access to people reporting it and having cell phones and all that sort of stuff. You know, it's funny. I don't know. I think that there's a lot of, it's not considered as much a crime when a woman does that with a young boy and a student as it is the other way around.
Well, I think you're right. And again, I think that's part of the societal attitudes towards that type of offense. And, you know, those things need to change, irregardless of the gender of the perpetrator and whether or not the victim is a boy or a girl or a young man or young woman. You know, that type of crime is still a crime, and it shouldn't matter either way whether, you know, the victim is a young boy or girl or the perpetrator is a male or a female.
Yeah. It shouldn't matter, but I don't know. It's just something about it. I mean, and look at Mary Kay Letourneau, and they've made a movie about it and the whole thing, right? And
oh, yeah. What's interesting is the impact these crimes have on the victims. You know, they're much higher rates of post-traumatic stress syndrome and disorder, PTSD, and suicide rates, drug use. I remember years ago I had a young victim came in, a woman. She was probably in her early 20s and wanted to talk to an investigator. So I sat down with her, and she had talked about how she had been raped about 6 or 7 years earlier when she was a teenager. She was out past her curfew, was trying to sneak back home to avoid getting in trouble with her parents, and she took a shortcut on a jogging path, and some guy had walked past her. As soon as he got behind her, he turned around and blitzed her from behind, knocked her down and dragged her into the bushes there and raped her with a knife, and she had never reported it. And I asked her why she was reporting it now, and she said her life had become unmanageable. So even 6 years afterwards, you know, there was probably no way of finding the perpetrator. She had gone to her employee assistance program at work, and they said, you need to tell the police about this as part of the healing process.
Yeah. What about the, have you dealt with some of the fake rape charges, like where someone says that they were attacked or raped somewhere at a, you know, at a party or a bar or someone's house, and it turns out to be not real.
Yeah, it's a problem because you end up investing a lot of time and resources into a fake report, and when it's, you know, especially if they give you the name of a perpetrator and you track that person down, but they're usually pretty easy to spot. I remember one case in particular. We had a chronic false reporter. She would report a false rape about every 6 or 8 months. Finally, the last one she had reported, I drove her out to the scene where she said it had happened, and it was tall grass off of a park, a little walking path in a park. And I said, well, show me exactly where he grabbed you and dragged you into the brush here so I can see where it happened. Maybe he left some evidence, that type of thing. And she's real hesitant, and her story didn't make sense. She changed it a number of times. And finally, she took me to this one spot, and she walked in a little ways. Well, you could tell just from her footprints in that fresh brush that nobody had been in there before, and yet she claimed that she had wrestled around with a guy trying to resist his attack, and, you know, there was obvious that the grass was not crushed down and stuff, and it hadn't occurred there. And finally, when I confronted her with that fact, and she broke down and told me that, well, she was making it up, and that wasn't able to identify or get a reason from her why she made these false reports, but they're not real common. I think the national average is about 10%. But they do such damage because they waste so much time, and most of the time detectives are pretty busy and don't have a lot of time to spend investigating a fake case. So, you know, if you can head those off at the pass, and a lot of times you can because the stories don't make sense, and, you know, you can usually weed them out. But again, you have to err on the side of caution and investigate it because it might be true.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, and it costs a lot of money. Do those people get charged then for costing so much time and money?
They can, but my experience has been that the prosecutors don't want to take the case to trial. They get arrested for false reporting, and, you know, because it is such a waste, a drain on resources. But a lot of times they'll get a good defense attorney. He'll say, well, I'll get my client into mental health counseling, and they do, you know, they go into counseling, and then they drop the charges and stuff. And, you know, and nobody wants to see somebody with a mental illness that their demons caused them to make fake rape reports go to jail, but by the same token, it's a really big drain on resources when you have to spend time tracking down things that don't make sense because the story's phony.
Do you get a lot of old crime reports too? You know, like how, you know, we've seen Bill Cosby and things in the news, and how people come up years later and say, well, this happened, you know, and is that a common occurrence?
It's not a common occurrence. It's more common in homicides. They're called cold cases. In Nebraska, I think they've changed the law recently, but it used to have a 3-year statute of limitations that if a felony crime like sexual assault was not solved within 3 years, you couldn't prosecute a perpetrator if you found him anyway. But I think in some cases they changed those because they recognized the fact that victims may not come forward for a number of years past the statute of limitations, so they may have lengthened it. I'm not, since I've been retired 10 years, I don't keep track of that stuff anymore. But yeah, the cases like Cosby are kind of troubling because it looks like he was a predator. And again, I don't have all the facts, and I'm not here to pass judgment on the guy, but it looks like he was a serial predator for a long, long time. And, you know, you get that many cases, that many women coming forward, it's pretty hard to refute that, saying, well, you know, it's just a he said, she said difference of opinion. But, yeah, I've seen them. I've never worked one myself because they weren't real. They had never occurred, as far as I know, in my experience.
Well, this is a tricky question. But, you know, we saw the recently the justice, you know, Brett Kavanaugh and all that, and that whole thing broadcast. Now, is it common for someone not to remember all of the details in a rape?
It can be. You know, there's different theories about what the victim can recall, and whether or not it's better to interview them immediately after the crime occurred to get fresh details, or wait a while because maybe their mental processes through trying to heal from a crime like that other information will bubble up, that type of thing. I remember when I used to interview victims, I would tell them, you know, you give me the information that you've got now and call me if you have more information. And I would tell them, when you're sleeping at night, keep a pad and paper and pencil near the bed, because things that may not bubble up to the surface while you're awake sometimes do when you're sleeping. And if you don't write them down, you're not going to remember them when you wake up. And, you know, I've had victims call me and say, hey, look, I remember something else. I remember what he said or things like that, that you know, they might have suppressed because of the nature. I also found that you really, you know, when you talk to a victim, they seldom, depending on the nature of the rape, they seldom give you everything because some things are just too intensely embarrassing or personal. So you got to be a little cautious on that. But, yeah, I think it's fairly common or could be a common occurrence that they may not remember everything.
Hmm. So, now, is there such a thing as marriage rape today?
Well, I think there always has been. I think that in the past, and again, it's a societal attitude, it was considered, you know, a man supposedly raping his wife. It couldn't occur. It wasn't a crime, but... yeah, anytime somebody commits an act of sexual violence, it's a crime, whether regardless of the status of the victim. And hopefully that's changed a great deal now, because I know in some cases in the past, you know, I've actually had cops, other cops I work with, say, well, he can't rape her, that's his wife. Well, you know, I'm thinking to myself, doesn't she have the right to say no? I mean, how about if you're sitting someplace and somebody wants to do that to you and you say no? I mean, don't you have a right to say no? And so, yeah, I think it's probably, you know, the public information has come to light probably in the last 20, 25 years has destroyed much of that myth, but it probably still exists in a lot of quarters.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny how it's slowly progressed and how things are, because I remember a lot of things in the 60s and 70s that would never happen now.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it would never be accepted. And I guess with Me Too and all that stuff, it's brought a lot of awareness to... you know, what goes on and stuff like that. And now, quite often, I guess, these sex crimes do lead to murder, don't they?
Yes, they do. In fact, one of the four categories of rapists, the anger excitation rapist, often engages in lust murder. And his goal may be to start out as, you know, raping his victim over and over, but the injuries that the victim sustains during those attacks leads to her death. But so you've got one category, rapist in particular, who's extremely dangerous because their desire to control another human being includes the control over whether or not they live, which is probably the ultimate form of control. And so, yes, it's very possible. In fact, I used to tell some of the detectives working for me when I was training them that, you know, rape is a life-threatening crime. It may not lead to a death each and every time, but that victim straddles a precarious shifting line during that rape. And that victim or that perpetrator could easily kill her because she's under his control at that time.
Hmm. And, you know, one thing that I've seen in the news, we see come through, and there's been a few of them, actually. It's kind of surprising how it happens, and I don't know if you've dealt with it, but people that have been kidnapped or held hostage in a house, you know, or three or four girls, and the perpetrator keeps them there for years and rapes them until they're discovered and escape. That's kind of the same style of crime, too, isn't it?
Yes, it is. In fact, that's probably a form of that anger, excitation, rapist, or lust murder. He just doesn't rise to the level of murder because he's able to control his victim for a long period of time. The one case that I did work, because those type of rapes are the most rare. The guy was kind of a low-functioning individual, not very intelligent, and he was the one that was targeting prostitutes. Because he didn't have a lot of money and probably wasn't the sharpest knife in a drawer, he would pick up a prostitute, take her to a remote location, and it happened to be a place where he used to mow lawns years before, so he was intimately familiar with the nooks and crannies, these areas where he could get off the beaten path and rape the woman without being interrupted. And but again, the higher order, the higher functioning anger, excitation rapist, they can keep somebody bound and chained up for years and use them as a sex slave. But oftentimes they tend to be increasers, which means that their level of violence goes up. And so as they increase the level of violence, of course, the danger to the victim increases also, leading to their death. But they had one recently in South Carolina, I believe. I think the guy's name was Holkip. And he had lured a young girl to come out to his property to clean it. She showed up with her boyfriend. He ended up killing him in front of the girl and then chained her up in a shipping container. And the police got a missing person report. They were able to track her to her last known cell phone pings, and it was close to his property. When they opened up the shipping container, she was chained up like a dog. He would come in and rape her and then chain her back up again. So, you know, they're capable of extreme violence. And in this case, she probably would have killed her to dispose of her before he went on to his next victim.
Do you think this is a touchy one, but do you think justice system is working strong enough? Or is it, like, with someone like that guy, what really happens to them? Do we just send them for treatment? Do they get a couple of years in jail? Or are they getting enough?
A lot of times they're getting enough. The problem is, you know, it's a revolving door, because you're not going to, unless the guy has committed a murder, he's going to get out. And when he gets out, if he hasn't aged out where he's too old or infirm to commit these crimes, he's going to go back and commit the crimes. But in the case of this Henry Camphouse here in Omaha, he was raping disposable victims of prostitutes. And when it came time for trial, I mentioned before that, you know, they were hard to find and they weren't real credible on the stand. So the prosecutor decided he was going to accept the plea bargain. He went to prison for 4 years, I believe, and got out in 4 years. The problem was he went to prison for other than sex crimes, so he's not on the sex offender registry. It doesn't have to be monitored. He's probably going to go back out and start raping again, and now society has no information on him. At least if he'd been convicted of a sex crime and the prosecutor was aware of the fact that this guy was an anger excitation rapist, the most dangerous kind, the most resistant to training and behavior modification, he would have insisted on the fact that he had been convicted of a sex crime so that he would be sex offender, be on the sex offender monitor system for the rest of his life. So in this case, the guy's a serial rapist. He's out, and he served his time, so he's no longer on parole or anything, and he's free to commit his crimes again, and nobody is the wiser.
Hmm. Do you think the sex offender list and registry really works, or is it real? Do people use it enough?
I think they do, but again, it's an imperfect system. The key is that the sex offender registry, I used to manage that function. I had detectives working for me that made sure that they tracked these guys down. What it did was it was another tool in the toolkit, and it stripped away the anonymity that rapists and serial offenders hid behind. Once they were identified and the community knew about it, you know, people were aware that they had a serial sex offender, a high-risk sex offender living in their neighborhood, they would keep their kids in. They would, you know, depending on who he targeted, if it was an adult, they would know they had a sex offender in their midst. And before the sex offender monitoring occurred, that never took place. One of the things that happened early on in my career was he had a serial murderer in town. And he had murdered two young boys. They were both, one of them was snatched only several blocks from my house. And his name was John Jubert. He was ultimately executed in the Nebraska electric chair. But we found out working those cases was just a number of predators that were out there that we had no information on. We would knock on doors and they would say, hey, by the way, did you know this guy down here does this or this guy? You know, we never knew that. And the sex offender registry works because it identifies these people. It doesn't identify everybody, because like in the case of Henry Campos, you have to be convicted of a sex offense to be placed on that system. But it does strip away the anonymity that they hid behind. So in the process, they could target other victims by living next to a school, for example, or some place where they could surveil children, if that was their MO. So yeah, I think it works. It's a powerful tool, but it's not perfect.
Yeah. Wow. What an interesting, it's an interesting subject, and quite, imagine quite stressful at times. Let's give out your contact information. So if someone wants to pick up your book, or if they want to contact you, maybe they have a story or something, how do they do
sure.
that?
The book is at the Genius Book Publishing website. Supposed to be out mid-year of 2019. It might be out a little early since I finished it early, but geniusbookpublishing.com. If they want a description of it, they can click on the news tab and scroll down a little bit, and it appears there, a little blurb about it appears there. I don't put out a lot of contact information. Somebody once asked me, how come you're not on social media? Well, in 30 years, I put a lot of deserving people into prison, and I prefer to make it as hard as possible for them to come knocking on my door. So I don't have a lot of contact information out there. They can contact the publisher, who'll get information to me, and I'll be glad to return calls or emails and stuff, but I don't put my information out.
Okay, sounds good. Well, we're going to have that linked up to our site as well, and so listeners can just go right on and do a one click, and we should have you on again just before the book comes out. Give it another little push, let people know when it's coming out.
Be happy to do that.
Great. Well, our guest has been Dean T. Olson, and we've been talking about his books. His newest one coming out, Evil Desire, and it's reflections of a sex crime detective. And that's coming out in June, but if it's sooner, we'll let everybody know. Thank you for being here, Dean.
Thank you very much.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.